Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Malo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It is Wednesday, March 25. I'm Kyle Evans coming to you from Melbourne, the land of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up today, a 7.6 magnitude earthquake triggers a tsunami alert and sparks fears in Tonga.
You know, the house was moving, and that's why we ran outside, and we see the house is shaking when we stood outside.
Also, decaying bombs left over from World War II pose a new threat to Solomon Islanders, and a new documentary film illustrates the devastating impacts of deforestation in West Papua.
Indonesia government, or Indonesia, is really occupy West Papua just for natural resource, and this is a very primitive colonialism, and using military as well.
We've got all that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Thanks for tuning in. But first, Fiji's Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions is defending the move to grant immunity to several people charged in connection to the country's largest cocaine bust. Police seized more than 2.6 tonnes of the drug at a remote jetty in mid-January and arrested 10 locals and 6 foreign nationals on a range of drug charges. The High Court released 5 of the local defendants on bail on Monday after hearing they'd been granted immunity to help the prosecution. Without referring to specifics of the current case, Prosecutor John Rembuku says the general aim of immunity deals is to catch the big fish. Here he is speaking to Fiji reporter Lithe Mavono.
Immunity is usually granted to a smaller fish in a group, but who knows everything, or who knows most of everything. Or sometimes it's granted to somebody who knows, say, half of the planning, and it's granted also to somebody who can support that evidence or knows about the other half of the planning. And it's always critical for group offending, especially when group offendings are done in secret or what was planned to be committed did not eventuate. This is for conspiracy. We're able to lead us for conspiracy because it's specifically provided for under the Illicit Drugs Controls Act. And it's also provided, you know, as an offense under our Crimes Act. And so providing immunity to particular witnesses strengthens the state's case because these are the people who were present during the planning. And when we provide them immunity, when they talk about what really happened, you are able then to corroborate that from the rest of the evidence that's coming in. So in that way, it strengthens the state's case against, say, one or two or the rest of the people who are part of the planning. In conspiracy cases, what we're always looking for is the main guy, the big fish, so to speak, you know, in that group. We're not interested in the small fish. That's why we give, you know, we're not interested in him going to jail. We want him to talk about who really started all this and who was going to benefit from it.
How do we keep them safe? How will authorities keep them safe in the duration of this trial?
There are no provisions to keep them safe. You know, there are no provisions to keep them safe. They are responsible for their own safety. They are on big bail conditions. But I guess most of them, if not all of them, are happy that they've been granted immunity because none of them rejected the immunity offer. In particular, we had offered immunity to somebody else also in the second group. It was not forthcoming, so we withdrew that immunity and then we gave it to somebody else in that same group. So when they're outside, their safety is really their own responsibility. Because here in Fiji, we don't have the provisions, neither do we have the resources within the police force or the office of DPP to be able to protect witnesses.
Do you think that could be a hindrance to the ability of accused persons to offer up evidence they might have in exchange for immunity?
Well, see, everybody wants immunity. That's the bottom line. Everybody wants immunity in this type of big drug cases because they know that, you know, if the state proves its case, they're going in for 20 years or more. Despite everyone wanting immunity, we at the DPP's office, we decide who should be given immunity. You know, because everyone wants to get away with not being charged for this large It's not shipments. And with the ones who now remain on the information, of course, immunity offers, you know, are still open. If we see that whatever evidence they provide is useful in the grander scheme of things, you know, in terms of like these large shipments.
That was Fiji's Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions, Prosecutor John Rambuku, speaking there with Lithe Mavona. So rugby union in Samoa, and it could soon have not one but two governing bodies, with the government revealing plans to establish a new national rugby union to rival existing union, Lakapi Samoa. Prime Minister Luiatia Politeva'o-Schmidt announced the plans after his letter demanding the removal of Lakapi Samoa's current board members was refused. It comes as the Australian government waits to sign off on $150 million for rugby programs in Samoa, Tonga and Fiji. To discuss things further, I'm joined by rugby analyst with the New Zealand Herald, Gregor Paul. Gregor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it's certainly a unique situation, this one. First of all, what do you make of it all?
Look, I don't think it's great optics for Samoa Rugby Union to be, you know, to be doing this. Firstly, high level of government interference in sport, which kind of plays against all the charters and World Rugby to begin with, but secondly, it's just ugly and messy and uncertain to be having this going on, and I think when you have a instability in governance or administration in the way that this is playing out, it really erodes confidence, and when I say that, I mean it will erode the confidence of players who are eligible to play, who currently do play for Samoa. That will make them wary. Some might just decide, actually, I don't want to do this. There'll be guys who haven't yet, given their eligibility to Samoa, who'll be thinking, jeepers, I definitely don't want to be doing that now. World Rugby won't be looking at that favourably. Any potential sponsors won't be looking at this well. And to your intro point about the Australian government about to sign off on a big tranche of money, well, we'll have to see what happens there. But again, I wouldn't be overly confident about the fate of that money working its way into Samoa at the moment.
No, and I don't think the Australian government would be all that confident handing that money over, knowing what we know now. Before we move on, Samoa, once a very celebrated rugby nation, have gone deep into World Cups in the past. I mean, how did they reach this point over the last few years?
Well, I guess what we're seeing playing out has been a story that has rumbled along for quite some time. Poor governance, unstable governance, poor administration. That's been a story, I think, that's played through since the 2011 World Cup, when Mo Schwalger, the Samoan captain, had his say and talked about the issues of corruption that he felt were happening in the administrative side of the game. I don't think that's ever really been fixed up. This has taken it to a nuclear level. Which it may be in one way is not such a bad thing, because it's probably blown it up to the extent that it will now have to be dealt with. But I think that has put everyone in a spiral where it's been very difficult for external bodies to have confidence in investing time, money into Samoa. There's a lack of trust that has sent players, to my point earlier, guys that have been eligible to play for Samoa have probably made decisions that say we're not going to. There's no ability to generate match fees for players when they play for Samoa, and then there's no ability. It's all cyclical and it all falls apart, because there's then no ability for Samoa to get a fixture list that makes players want to sign up and play. Because when you find yourself playing in Tbilisi and the not so attractive places of the world. I shouldn't pick on Georgia. I didn't mean to, but I think the point being, like the fixture list of playing Canada, Georgia, and Romania, as opposed to playing England, Scotland, and Wales, doesn't seem attractive to Samoan players. So the whole thing is cyclical and just falls apart.
Yeah, no, look, you're absolutely right. And I guess on top of that, there's been some swings, I suppose, that they've taken in recent times, which haven't really paid off in the way they might have hoped, one of which is Moana Pacifica, who have actually, I guess, played quite an indirect role in the decline of rugby in Samoa and maybe to a lesser extent Tonga. Can you elaborate a little bit on Moana Pacifica's role in all this?
Yeah, like it is indirect. It is important to stress that. I think what it's done is it was set up. Moana Pacifica came into the Super Rugby competition, New Zealand and Australia's Super Rugby competition in 2022, under a great remit. And the remit was effectively to create a pathway for Samoan and Tongan players to find players both currently in Samoa and Tonga, give them the opportunity to access good coaching, good nutrition, and build a team that could represent both countries under one umbrella, if you like, at a club level, capture all those players that were maybe kind of drifting into New Zealand and Australian teams because there was nowhere else for them to go, build that up, and then spit them back out into Samoa and Tongan international teams. And in time, the idea was that more and more this team would be based in Samoa / Tonga to train, to play. What that's done is it's shown that the fact that they haven't, I think they've only played one game, and I might be wrong. If it's only one, I apologize if I'm not right with that. But the logistics and economics of playing in the islands have proven too difficult to overcome. They've found out really that the vast majority of talent, young boys particularly, are already kind of out of Samoa and Tonga at the age of 15, 16, because they're being lured over to New Zealand and Australia through education programs predominantly, or family members are bringing kids over that might have shown a bit of talent and putting them into schools over here. So there is no pipeline of talent on the islands. It's already over here in New Zealand particularly. So all of these things have turned out to be very difficult to manage. And what it's done is it's kind of said, what is the future for the Samoan and Tongan national teams? Because there's no pipeline of talent that's going to feed, you know, a promising kid at 15 back into the Samoan and Tongan teams. And there's no economic formula that seems to be working to host rugby games in either country, either at club level or international level. So, you know, what are we going to do here? And it looks like everyone's just put it in the far too hard basket and realized that, where are we with all this?
Yeah, and I guess that's in some ways been indicative of what we've seen from, well, what we've heard come out of Moana Pacifica since the start of the year. Obviously, about 15 players walked away in the off-season, which raised some red flags when I saw that. I guess if they do collapse, because they haven't collapsed yet, and I want to point that out, but if they do fall over, what questions will that place over not only Super Rugby, but I guess Pacific Rugby as a whole?
Look, it'll be fairly devastating, I think, for Pacific Rugby. Super Rugby will weather it. You know, it won't be great, but they're a bigger entity. They'll still have 10 teams. They'll still have enough money and momentum to carry on, and they'll reshape. But it does beg the question, what is the future for Pacific Rugby? And it will probably accentuate what we currently have, which is really it's a migratory process for Samoa and Tongan talent that they're going to be encouraged off the island. Both countries are going to be lured into, the best players are going to be lured into New Zealand, lured into Australia, lured further afield, whether it's rugby, whether it's NRL, whether it's even the NFL. I mean, there's such a rich talent pool there that I think that will be its future. And all these really talented athletes, everyone will scramble yet harder under the guise of educational opportunity to bring them to New Zealand. But in many cases, they're really just being used, given an opportunity to bolster a rugby team at a school because you've got a principal with a giant ego that wants his team to win. And this will be the fate. And these guys will become eligible to play for New Zealand or Australia, and that's what will happen. You know, they'll make that choice to play for New Zealand and Australia. Very difficult to see how Samoa, Tongan international teams get a decent fixture list, how they can attract, you know, their own players to come and play for them, how they're going to drive revenue to attract players to come and play for them. And I just think we'll be stuck in this pattern And what we'll be seeing is that at come Rugby World Cup time, I don't think we'll see strong Samoan or strong Tongan international teams at those competitions.
Yeah, that's really sad. I mean, and obviously, yeah, Moana Pacifica, the idea was to get around that exact problem. Is there any lifelines potentially available to them? I don't know if it's, you know, the New Zealand government or anyone like that, or I don't know, World Rugby. Is there anything possible, do you think?
Look, I think they're running out of options, and I say that with a heavy heart because I think everybody wants this thing to continue. The New Zealand government is probably a no. I don't think that they have the interest or the fiscal ability to do it, because the issue with Moana is finding a home for the actual club. Now, the club has to play somewhere, has to have a base somewhere. Mm-hmm. Auckland is the natural base for Moana Pacifica to play. Unfortunately, however, the Blues rugby team, which is an established member of Super Rugby, has been here for 30 years and has a very strong Pacific flavour itself. It also has a licence that prevents any competitive entity playing in its area. So the ability for Moana to play its games in Auckland is limited by that licence. And this is why we've seen Moana be a fairly nomadic team, bouncing around New Zealand trying to play their games wherever they can. Makes that very difficult to build a fan base. And New Zealand just can't really have a sixth Super Rugby team. So I don't see the government coming to the rescue. World Rugby look like they're kind of, and certainly to given what's happening at the administrative and governance side of Samoa, I don't think New Zealand already government would be keen. But you know, there's a big pot of money in Australia. It's a much richer country, wealthier country. The government seems to be motivated to use this money diplomatically. It's got its reasons. And could Moana be shifted to, I don't know, Sydney, Melbourne, somewhere, and the Australian government pick up the tab and do it that way? I mean, I think that's maybe the only lifeline left for Moana.
Well, I guess knowing what we know, Australia is obviously about to splash that $150 million in the region to, from what I've read, fund new rugby programs. How do you think that money can best be spent, knowing the challenges that are in place?
Well, look, I think, first and foremost, if they're going to spend that amount of money, it's probably pretty critical that, you know, everyone in those two countries wants to have access to picking up a rugby ball and, you know, having the joy of playing the game at some kind of structured level with a bit of coaching and a bit of understanding. I think that's the most important thing. That's where that government money should be spent, on participation first. But secondly, I think if it's got a diplomatic aim behind it, then to the points that we've raised here, there needs to be some leveling in the sense that the pathway has to be there for people of Samoan and Tongan heritage who are elite players to be able to play the game at the highest level and not be financially penalised for committing to play for Samoa or Tonga. So there needs to be a sense that if you go and play for Samoa, you know, you'll be able to earn, you're not going to earn what you earn as an All Black or a Wallaby, but you do need to not be financially penalised. You do need to be going into a team where you're not paying your own airfare. Yeah. You know, that kind of stuff would be, I mean, it's kind of incredible that actually still happens. Or, you know, if you've got to have trust that if you go and play, you'll get paid your match fee, and your match fee won't be, you know, massively less than what, you know, other international nations pay their players. So these basic things, you need to allow a way that people don't, Samoan and Tongan athletes don't think, the last thing I want to do is commit to play for Samoa and Tonga. I want to go and do it because it's a fair and reasonable opportunity for me to showcase. I'll get to go to World Cup. We'll get some good fixtures along the way. We'll be a competitive team. And if that money can be used to do that, because, you know, I still remember, I'm old enough, watching what was called Western Samoa playing in Edinburgh back in 1991 at the World Cup, and it was incredible, you know. Mm. And I know what it did for Samoans. And again, if we could get both Samoa and Tonga to be really competitive again, which they can be, on the international stage, I think government money would be really well spent if there's a bit of pride put back in those nations.
I think we'd all love to see that, and I hope the Australian government is listening, because you've raised some great points. Gregor, that's all we've got time for today, but thanks so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
My pleasure.
That was rugby analyst with the New Zealand Herald, Gregor Paul.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. A 7.6 magnitude earthquake sparked fear and panic in Tonga yesterday afternoon after it triggered tsunami sirens across the kingdom. The evening earthquake struck near the island of Vava'u and occurred at a depth of more than 200 kilometres, yet it could be felt hundreds of kilometres away as the capital Nuku'alofa, where mass evacuation took place, with people promoted to move to safety zones. School children were evacuated to higher ground and told to wait for the alert to die down. Meanwhile, closer to the quake's epicentre on the island of Vava'u, Marion Lahapi told Pacific Beat's Finau Fanua her house moved up and down in the quake.
It was very strong, and I was in the house with the family. So it's just me and my two kids and my husband. And we were shocked when it was started to shake. And I thought it's going to be end, but, you know, it took long to end to shaking. But we felt it. It was very strong. Yeah, and my two kids, you know, I think this is the first time for them to experience this.
I can hear the sirens in the background, so it's still going.
Because we are at the main town now, but we cannot hear it from where I stay. But we are at the main town, at a store in the main town.
You've evacuated to a safe place?
No, where we live, if so.
Can you describe the reaction from people around you? Do you see people evacuating or kind of in fear, panicking?
Really, I don't really see people evacuating on our way here. Our neighbors too, I don't see any evacuating to other places. We just stayed in our own house.
When the earthquake happened, did anything fall? How strong was it? Could you describe?
The house was moving, and that's why we ran outside, and we see the house is shaking when we stood outside. But only one neighbor came outside. You know, the mother and the daughter, they came outside, and we talked outside, seeing the house was moving.
How many times have you experienced earthquakes like this?
I think this is the first time to experience a very strong earthquake, and it was long. This is my first time to experience this in Vava'u. We had earthquake before, but it's not very strong like this one. You know, on our way to the shop, I did not see any like people on the way to evacuate to other places.
Why do you think that is? Why is that?
I just thought because I think that people, you know, they feel safe at where they are now. But I don't know about people who are living close to the ocean. I think they are the only people who try to evacuate to other places, you know, to a higher places.
That was Vava'u resident Marion Lahapi explaining how she was affected by yesterday's 7.6 magnitude earthquake. And she was speaking there to Pacific Beat's Finau Fanua. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, landmines, munitions and unexploded ordnance left over from the Second World War pose major safety risks to communities in the Pacific, but now new research has proven they don't need to explode to threaten lives. A study from the University of Queensland and United Nations Development Program has found thousands of decaying bombs in Solomon Islands are releasing toxic chemicals onto land and sea, threatening the health of locals in coastal areas. The environmental impact assessment is the first of its kind to be carried out, and to find out more, we are joined by the UNDP Solomon Islands Deputy Resident Representative, Raluca Eden. Raluca, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
No, thank you for joining us. Now, it's been 84 years since that Guadalcanal campaign, but the island is obviously still laced with unexploded ordnance. What's happening to them now after all this time?
We are finding that the chemicals are seeping into the soil, rivers, and coastal ecosystems, and they can persist for a long time, contaminate sediments, and enter the food chain. So over time, this affects water quality, damages ecosystems, and reduces the safety of land and fishing areas that communities rely on for their livelihoods.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a really interesting study. So can you take us through, I guess, what kind of bombs your study focused on? Are we talking like unexploded shells, grenades, were they ammo dumps, a bit of everything?
A bit of everything, actually. The study looked at a wide range of World War II ordnance, and this included aerial bombs, artillery shells, naval munitions, grenades, and ammunition stockpiles. We also looked at former dump sites, both on land and in coastal waters, to understand how contamination moves through the environment.
Yeah, right. And how are they degrading? Is it just a matter of 80 years of environmental impacts just sort of rusting away at them or something like that?
Well, we are finding that they are contaminating the land areas and also affecting marine lives. Marine ecosystems, explosive residue, for example, in shellfish that we collected from coastal areas shows that contamination is moving through the food chains. And communities have reported symptoms after eating seafood from these locations, including rashes and vomiting, illness in infants through breastfeeding. And while more research certainly is needed, the exposure pathways are quite clear.
Yeah, I did read some of those really alarming findings, particularly around the explosive residues found in seafood. So, how has that impacted the health of local people?
From what people are telling us, we now know that they feel sick after eating clams or fish, for example, from certain areas. So they generally avoid those places. They also told us that they cannot farm in certain areas because of the heavy contamination. And they also shared their fears, especially mothers, especially for children living and playing near such threats.
Yeah, God, it's really concerning stuff. Now, obviously, it's not just the land that these bombs are degrading. It's the maritime environment as well. Now, like the shellfish and things like that are one thing, but what about like the marine environment, like the coral and things like that? Does it have an impact in that area?
That's a very good question, Kyle, and that suggests that, in fact, much more research is needed. So this was a first step, looking at contaminated shellfish and how the pollution is moving through the food chain. But certainly we need to gain a much better understanding of the broader impacts, including on coral reefs.
Yeah. Now, I understand that you yourself live in the Solomon Islands. I know you've spoken to a lot of the communities that live close to these UXOs. What kind of stories have you heard from them in your time in the Solomon Islands, just in terms of what they've got to deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Indeed. We see that, in fact, UXO impacts the many facets of people's lives. And that's why we also think that this is more than just not an environmental story or just a story about security. It is a story, it's a development story fundamentally, because it affects food, health, and livelihoods. And it will have an impact on the development of these areas.
Yeah. So can you expand on that a little bit? Like when you say like development of the areas, does it prevent them from, like building an economy or things like that, or just being able to expand essentially?
There's probably multiple dimensions to this question. So on a personal level, of course, it prevents farmers from accessing their fields. It raises fears in the communities about the quality of their water. It means that mothers have to worry about their children who develop mouth ulcers as a result of being exposed to contaminated breast milk. So there is that human aspect, but there is also a bigger picture, which is about the hidden economic costs of these health and environmental impacts that place an undue and very heavy burden on a developing country like Solomon Islands.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. Now, I know there's a lot of, there's certain NGO groups who do a lot of work in this space, like the Halo Trust. They go in and clean this ordinance up, and they do a fantastic job. But I guess just to give the listeners an idea, you know, it was Guadalcanal was such a huge battle at the time. Like, how much ordinance remains in the country? Like, can you measure it, or is it just impossible to measure?
Well, we know it has been cleared, and so the focus mainly until now has been on the immediate danger of explosions, which have saved many lives. What is new now is that the science is showing the long-term environmental contamination. So we estimate that about 65% of the remaining ordinances on Guadalcanal. We also know that a lot of it is very close to the coastline, so within 1 kilometer, or most of it within 5 kilometers of the coastline. So this is an accelerating crisis, an accelerating problem that is worsened by climate change, because, of course, with increasing floods or extreme weather events, more of the UXO gets exposed, and therefore the risk of contamination increases.
Yeah, God. I mean, and what do you think is the best course of action in terms of mitigating these risks? Like, does there need to be more external help from foreign governments? I know that the Japanese government obviously played a part in this particular project, but does the US or Australian government, do they need to do more? Like, what would be the best course of action, do you think?
I'm really glad you asked that question. So this is a story of a challenge, but it's also a story of hope. It's a story of partners coming together. The Solomon Islands government has been leading this effort with support from development partners, which shows how the legacy of war can actually be turned into a story about recovery and resilience. But much more needs to be done. And that is also why the UNDP is involved. Supporting the government in its efforts for faster clearance, and especially in high-risk areas and fishing grounds and farming areas and reefs. Also, better monitoring of water and food. And this requires, of course, partners to come together. Japan, as you've mentioned, has been an important partner. Australia is sharing a history with Solomon Islands, and obviously what affects Solomon Islands affects regional stability and health. And we are happy that in this case, solutions are both the practical and the responsible thing to do.
Yeah, well, it's great that people like yourself are in the Solomon Islands and are able to carry out this sort of work. But yeah, like you said, it sounds like there's a lot more work that needs to be done. So hopefully in the coming years some more aid and funds can be injected into the region to help out, and hopefully it's not still there in another 80 years, Raluca.
Well, we certainly hope so, and we are happy that this is actually a problem that we know the solution to. It has practical solutions. It is doable. And it definitely is a story about multilateral action delivering real results.
Perfect. Well, we'll leave it there because we are running out of time. But Raluca, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat today, and good luck with the work that you'll continue to do.
Thanks so much. Thank you for having me.
No worries at all. That was UNDP Solomon Islands Deputy Representative Raluca Eden joining us there on the line from Honiara.
Join Natasha Metten for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
So we wanted to create a safe space for our Pacifica families to come and learn, share from each other. First started was mostly boys that were on the spectrum, and now there's quite a few girls that have been diagnosed.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is Wednesday, March 25, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and I just wanted to bring you a quick update before we move on with the rest of the show, because you may notice some changes on ABC Radio Australia later today. From 11 a.m. onwards, we will go into pre-recorded programming, meaning there won't be any news bulletins or live shows. The reason for that is because ABC staff are taking protected industrial action for a period of 24 hours. That means our Pacific Beat show tomorrow morning will be a pre-recorded episode. So if you're after any news, just head over to ABC Pacific. ABC Radio Australia, meanwhile, will return to normal programming from 11 a.m. PNG time on Thursday, so tomorrow. Well, a landmark James Cook University study has found Australian South Sea Islanders are disadvantaged when it comes to accessing education, health and housing. The study combined both quantitative data using information from the census with qualitative data using the Pacific method of talk story to document people's lives. Clancy Fitnawa, the president of Queensland United Australian South Sea Islander, the president of the Queensland United Australian South Sea Islander Council, told Lucy Cooper the results of the study didn't surprise him, but instead provides the community with an evidence base of what they already knew.
There's no data to actually go back to have conversations with government and other stakeholders. Utilising the talk story method and having that ability to be able to overlay it against the ABS data actually has set, I guess, a starting point. Talk story is, you know, the oral side of our culture, and I found it difficult to comprehend when they started because I couldn't see how they could garnish data from the stories then to be able to put it into a format that we could then utilise to have evidence-based discussions. I wasn't sceptical, but I did have a bit of a concern. But then working in with the researchers at JCU, including a statistician, he'd done a deep dive into the ABS data, provided what already existed, then utilised what was found with the talk story method of research that JCU did, to be able to get results around, you know, areas of concern with health, chronic disease in particular, also from the education level and also with housing and employment. So, yeah, in my mind, it was a mishmash of information, but what JCU and used utilising the talk story method, they've been able to extract the data that we need.
A key recommendation of the JCU report is the creation of funded Australian South Sea Islander navigators. What would this look like?
I guess it goes back to what our elders in the 90s had conversations and before that. We were looking at providing support for community that kept us in the determination pathway, which allowed us to have our choice, but also to have conversations with regards to adjustment of policy and process. So that model of support fits into that. It's cost effective, but also, you know, allows us to have autonomy with regards to what we say and what we need.
And the study also mentioned the importance of the census, with serious undercounting of Australian South Sea Islanders occurring. How can this be solved?
Yeah, well, what QASIC is looking at and supporting is we will do a state tour leading up to the August 11 ABS census. And really promote to community about how to identify. There were some underlying issues with regards to how they identified and I guess putting themselves into a position where they could possibly bring themselves under review. It's probably the best way to put it. And there was reluctance by community to identify because of that. And what I mean by that is, in just for example, I don't want to open Pandora's box, but just with regards to the utilisation of government housing and how many of our family members we have in our housing at the moment. That has the potential there to bring them into disrepute. ABS has reassured us that the data collected is confidential and de-identified, and we want to get out there and promote that information in partnership with the ABS, that we need to collect especially the identification part about how to identify as an Australian South Sea Islander, and we'll be moving on that in the next couple of months, Lucy, to really promote. Because I guess if you compare the 2021 ABS data collected and the 2016 data collected, there's a marked discrepancy. And what I mean by that is approximately 6,000 identified in 2016, and then we had a marked reduction in 2021. So we're trying to find out how we can promote our South Sea Islander heritage or identify our South Sea Islander heritage and get it into the onto the census form.
That was Clacey Fatinawa, the president of Queensland United Australian South Sea Islander Council, speaking there with Lucy Cooper. Pesty Babby, or Pig Feast, is a new documentary film about the devastating impacts of deforestation in West Papua, the Indonesian government's agribusiness schemes behind it, and the role Indonesia's military plays in it all. The film's makers allege the Indonesian government's national goals of food security and energy transition is a mask for economic gain and comes at the expense of indigenous communities and destroying millions of acres of land. The Pacific's Johnson Rayala sat down with director Dandi Laksono, a renowned journalist and producer Victor Mumbo, to talk about the film that's put their lives at risk.
I'm already facing a lot of intimidation, harassment. Of course, I'm worried.
Worrying is part of the survival and afraid as well. Some of my friends since said that the risk will increase because it's very sensitive, but at the same time, I think it's time to say loud and clear that, yeah, Indonesia government or Indonesia is really occupy West Papua just for natural resource, and this is a very primitive colonialism and using military as well. While we are doing this interview, we have cases that human rights activists was, you know, attacked with acid in Jakarta just 2 days ago. So it's a new level of violence in public, in Indonesia now.
Why is this film important for right now in terms of what is happening in West Papua?
First, because this is a very active armed conflict. This is a humanitarian story there. People get shot and die, both sides, and mostly, of course, the civilian, who unarmed one. And second, because of that, we have then more than 100,000 IDPs. And the third is because this is the story of world's largest deforestation in our time now, 2.5 million hectares. It's not in Amazon, it's not in Gaza or Middle East in terms of the bloodshed. These are right in front of our door.
The audience have clear stories about West Papua, because maybe the audience only hear about the war, about the
violence, fighting.
Yeah, violent, but of course they need to know that there's a biggest deforestation in the world.
What's your response to the Indonesian government who say that these agribusinesses and the projects are important for food security, for energy security?
We saw that there's nothing to do with food security. For more than 30 years, Indonesian government tried to create a food estate with some model, you know, cutting 1 million hectare forest under the Suharto administration in 1996, and didn't work until now. After the deforestation is the energy thing. So because you already cut 1 million hectares forest, then it's a waste if you just let it go, and then you can plant it with oil palm plantation. So now the government tried to create bioethanol, sugarcane plantation, and then corn. The land that used to for the food stock now became to fuel. So it's limitless. If you convert rainforest to agriculture for food, for example, the limit is your stomach. Yeah, so this is the limit. We cannot enlarge our stomach. But if you convert rainforest to the fuel, then, you know, this, the sky is the limit.
So essentially what we're saying is that the Indonesian government is masking food security in terms of sugarcane, rice and corn,
yeah,
for economic benefits in terms of fuels.
And they use bioenergy or green energy as a must. So it's nothing to do with self-sufficient energy, self-sufficiency, because you're just feeding the private-based transportation system.
Now, Victor, as a legendary journalist in the region, your life has been, as we've discussed, threatened many times. What keeps you going in this fight for justice?
That is my land, and my people living there. I need to fight for them. That's my only choice.
What's your message to Pacific communities, media, around the visibility and reporting of West Papuan stories?
I travel a lot to Pacific Island, and I always say the sea level increasing every year. So where you guys in the Pacific Island can exit when the sea level rising up? Only us. Papua land, a big land.
The promised land?
Yeah, the promised land for the Pacific Islanders. We can save you. A lot of Pacific Island peoples come to visit West Papua and living there. So let's do something for West Papua.
Yeah, for Australian viewers, we have story that your money as a taxpayer used by Sugar Research Australia to develop a seed for the sugar cane that plant in West Papua now. This is a very multinational interest as well. So the profit company influence your public organization to help them develop a giant agribusiness in West Papua and using military backup. So I think it's very important for public in Australia to notice that.
That was director Dandi Laksono and renowned journalist and producer Victor Mambo speaking there to Johnson Raela on The Pacific. Well, it's taken for granted that most of the Pacific are the direct descendants of the Neolithic population known as the Lapita culture. Southeast Asian in origin, the Lapitas spread through the Pacific 3,200 years ago before the Papuan gene began to mix in about 1,000 years later. The Lapitas have left their trace across the Pacific in the form of distinctive pottery fragments and a shared language group, forms of which are spoken by all Pacific Islanders. But in Palau, there are no Lapita-style pottery fragments to be found, and their language, whilst the form of the shared language group, is distinctly different from the rest of the Pacific, making Palau an unknown gap in the history of Pacific settlement. Now, a new study on the DNA of ancient Palauans has found that, unlike other Pacific Islanders, the Southeast Asian and Papuan genetic mixture occurred before settlers first arrived in Palau. Independent researcher Joanne Aiken, who was part of the team of researchers that brought this study together, joins us today. Joanne, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
So what do we know about the Palauan genetic makeup, and what does it change about what we had previously assumed?
First and foremost, it was important to do this DNA study so that Palauans would know where their ancestors came from. This is something we all want to know, right? And what's interesting here is that the study results actually confirm some of their origin stories. Now, in an earlier study, we compared ancient DNA from Guam, Saipan, and Ponape, along with modern DNA from Guam, Palau, Ponape, and Chuuk, and we were able to define five migration streams into Micronesia, including the first remote Oceania lineages from the Marianas, Palau, and Southwest Pacific. And the Southwest Pacific lineage was the In that study, we didn't have any ancient DNA samples from Palau. And the archaeology tells us that the people first occupied Palau's rock islands and Babeldaob around 3,200 years ago. And around the same time as the Marianas and Southwest Pacific were reached in separate migration streams. So it was important that we examine the ancient DNA from Palau to decipher that migration pattern. And the data indicate that all the ancient individuals from Palau were of Papuan and East Asian admixture. Papuan, of course, refers to those with primary ancestry from New Guinea, Bismarck Archipelago, and the Solomon Islands. And in this case, the Papuan admixture is more closely related to people of the New Guinea Highlands. And when we compared the data from neighboring regions, we found that the East Asian ancestry part of the Palauan lineage is closely related to Eastern Indonesians. We learned that the admixture of East Asians and Papuans happened long before they traveled to Palau. That is, the East Asian ancestors were already mixing with people of Papuan ancestry close to a millennium before there was any significant movement into remote Oceania.
That's interesting. So, can you expand a little bit on, I guess, why that's so significant that you're seeing that mix of Southeast Asian and Papuan genes that go back this far on the timeline, I guess, before you, longer than you ever realized?
Absolutely. Well, our expectation was that the admixture of Papuan ancestry in Palauans occurred around the same time as in other remote Oceanians, which is about 2,500 to 2,000 years ago. So our new results of earlier Papuan admixture were surprising. And it's important to note that not only did the admixture occur 1,000 years before these people first arrived in Palau, but the earliest inhabitants of Palau and modern-day Palauans both have approximately 60% East Asian and 40% Papuan ancestry. Modern Palauans have maintained this genetic lineage for over 3,000 years, and this is the longest intact lineage that we've identified to date.
Wow. So what do we know about this sort of, let's call them a separate population that traveled through Southeast Asia and New Guinea? Like, are they an entirely different civilization?
Well, I wouldn't say that. People arrived in Palau about 3,200 years ago, but beginning around 4,000 years ago, the sea level was declining from its mid-Holocene high stand, and a long-term process that changed marine habitats and widened shorelines was ongoing. And so there was arable lowland soils beginning to accumulate on unoccupied islands. And at the same time, there was an increasing variability in the El Niño Southern Oscillation weather system. And that brought stronger monsoons and more frequent droughts. So these environmental changes may eventually have prompted mobile marine foragers from the northern Wallachia region to explore the uninhabited small island groups of western Micronesia, such as Palau, where these highly productive shallow marine habitats were emerging. So the people would have stopped there intermittently at first to take advantage of these newly emerging resources. And actually, some of the burials used in this study date to that early period.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned some of those surrounding Micronesian nations earlier, places like Guam and Chuuk and other areas of the Marianas. So did this study apply just to Palau, or can we assume that some of the same phenomena might have happened in some of those other surrounding islands in Micronesia?
Well, this study is specific to Palau. But the ancient DNA data were compared to many other groups in the Pacific. And what we're seeing is a greater complexity in the migration patterns and greater antiquity when it comes to movement of populations across the region. So other areas will certainly warrant closer scrutiny.
Yeah, absolutely. And will that potentially be the next step for you guys? Will you want to try and sort of expand this this research out to have a look at some of those other nations?
Well, I hope so.
Fantastic. And I suppose just lastly, you know, does this change, I mean, how big of an impact do you think this is in terms of changing our understanding of Pacific history as a whole?
These findings about the history of Palau have changed our understanding of the first settlement of remote Oceania. The study provides revisions to a long accepted model in academia known as the express train model. And it's a commonly accepted historical linguistics model that proposes a Taiwanese origin for a Pacific-wide dispersal of Neolithic populations from Taiwan to the Philippines and onward into Western Micronesia, including the Marianas and Palau. However, our findings contradict this model, and showing that the initial settlement of remote Oceania was not simply the result of a direct migration from Taiwan through the Philippines, we show that the path to Palau followed a more complex pattern and it incorporates alternative routes.
It's truly fascinating. I'll have to cut you off there, Joanne, because we are about to run into the clock. But thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for that work that you've carried out. That was Joanne Aiken, a team of researchers who brought that incredible story to us. But that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. We'll be back, though, at the same time on Friday morning. Thank you.